Hello there and welcome. Today is Friday, February 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an African-American actor is arrested on charges of faking his own assault.
This stunt was orchestrated by Smollett because he was dissatisfied with his salary. So he concocted a story about being attacked.
The remaining ISIS stronghold in Syria is getting closer to being eliminated. Also ahead, Pope Francis opens an unprecedented summit on priest sex abuse. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S.-backed forces are one step closer to liberating the last patch of Syrian territory held by the Islamic State terror group, but a final assault could still be days away. A coalition statement came hours after the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces broke a stalemate with IS fighters still holed up in the village of Baghouz, securing the release of hundreds of civilians, including women and children. Witnesses said they saw a convoy of trucks leave Islamic State's last enclave, carrying hundreds of people. At least two of the trucks carried men identified as IS fighters who had surrendered. Officials estimate there are still about 300 IS fighters left in Baghouz, with ongoing attacks continuing. Mario Ritter talks to VOA Istanbul correspondent Heather Murdoch, who is in Iraq, traveling to Baghouz, about the situation.
What I'm hearing from people who are on the ground in Baghouz right now in that area, that people are still coming out. Last night, it was believed that about 2,000 people were left in the areas where Islamic State militants are still fighting. Today, hundreds more people escaped and were transported up to a refugee camp. It is expected that, as you said, 1,000 people might be still in there or possibly more.
What have you heard about the condition of the people? How many are fighters? How many are family members?
The people who are left in the area where the militants are still fighting are either the militants themselves or probably their relatives, wives and children. The conditions for them, I would expect to be, and have been proven to be so far, very rough. They've been under siege for a long time. People come out of these kinds of fights, often starving, always traumatized. And, of course, they will have a lot of children with them that will need immediate care if it's available.
Do you know whether the Syrian Democratic Forces are equipped to handle this influx?
Well, the conditions at the main camp, the Al-Hol camp, are reported to be wretched. And that's the main camp where people are going to right now. Over this winter, about 30 children died from hypothermia, according to WHO. And as this spring is starting to get warmer, they're also facing a very, very hot summer. So the extreme weather and a lack of food and fuel have also been reported. They don't have the resources to take care of this many people without more help.
Have you heard anything about repatriation, where women, children, and the fighters themselves come from other countries?
It seems to be a stalemate at the moment, where the Syrian Democratic Forces say they don't have the resources to hold about 700 fighters and thousands of women and children that are family members of these fighters that are all foreign. But most countries have said that they do not want to take these fighters back to try them in their home countries. Recently, or I think Wednesday night, there was a transfer of 150 Iraqis to Iraq from Syria, which has been the largest by far transfer of captured militants from one country to the next. But it's also believed that there may be tens of thousands more Iraqis held in Syria as militants.
Are you finding that most are actually from Iraq?
It's actually not clear who these Iraqis actually are, if they were captured recently or if they were captured any time in the past few years that they've been fighting Islamic State militants. So, no, I don't know if they came directly from Baghouz or if they have been held for a long time. The Syrian Democratic Forces have been holding foreign fighters for now. It's been going on a couple of years that they've been winning this battle and therefore taking in foreign fighters. It's come to a head recently because the forces are saying they can't afford to take care of all these people.
What do you know about the international presence there, NGOs or other organizations?
Well, there are support organizations across Syria, but they're very limited in terms of their access to certain areas because of the fighting. and they're also limited in resources. They usually just don't have enough of anything to go around. The war has been going on now for a long time, and there's certainly sympathy fatigue is what they call it among NGOs, where for so long there's been so many people suffering, it's hard to keep interest in international support for all of the different battle zones.
All right, that is VOA Istanbul correspondent Heather Murdoch. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Thursday that an American-born woman who defected to the Islamic State terrorist group is not a U.S. citizen and shouldn't be allowed to return home from Syria because her father was a Yemeni diplomat. Pompeo said Thursday in an interview with the NBC Today show that the 24-year-old woman, now with a child born in a relationship with one of her three jihadist husbands, is not an American citizen because of her father's diplomatic status.
There are now over 800 terrorists that are being held, foreign terrorist fighters that are being held in Syria today. She's just one of them. She is a terrorist. She's not a U.S. citizen. She ought not return to this country.
President Trump on Twitter Thursday said he ordered Pompeo to not let Hoda Muthana return to the U.S., even though her lawyer says she's willing to face charges that she willingly went to Syria and used social media to praise the killings of Westerners. Her attorney, Hassan Shibli, says the father had ended his diplomatic service because his daughter was born in the U.S. state of New Jersey, thus making her an American citizen.
As a U.S. citizen, she's held accountable to U.S. law. She will likely have to return to face the criminal justice system. I'm sure she may face some serious charges, and she may ultimately have to spend time behind bars. And she's willing to do that. She realizes she was wrong. She was brainwashed. She made serious mistakes.
Muthana left her home in the southern state of Alabama in 2014 without her parents' knowledge to head to Syria to embrace Islamic State. She said she was immediately locked up with 200 other women and told she wouldn't be released unless she married one of the IS fighters. Now, with territory held by IS dwindling fast, Muthana has renounced extremism and wants to return home to confront any criminal charges she may face. The winners in Nigeria's general election Saturday will face a disturbing challenge: how to help millions of children in the country suffering from malnutrition. While hunger as a whole is gradually declining in Nigeria, the rate of acute malnutrition and stunted growth has seen little or no improvement. Timothy Obaizu reports from Abuja.
Samaila Shinguri and his wife's two-year-old triplets are not well. Shinguri says the couple could not afford to feed them properly as babies, and now they're suffering from malnutrition.
We are begging the government to help us because we don't have money to even buy food. We are begging the government.
The United Nations Children's Fund says child hunger in Nigeria is declining by about 3% per year. But the rate of severe acute malnutrition, the technical term for starvation, remains the same. The UN says 2.5 million Nigerian children are starving and only 1 in 5 of them get help. Nigeria's health ministry distributes food and treatment, but admits it's not enough.
It's really a serious issue of public health concern. Malnutrition has been on the rise. Yes, over 900,000 children die annually.
Widespread poverty, insecurity in the north, and poor health care are fueling child malnutrition. Medical experts like Dr. Adeyemi Adeniran are trying to show Nigerians how to give children a better start in life.
From the point of birth, the baby is being introduced to breastfeeding, and that is the cheapest and the best. But the advocacy and the awareness about this has been a bit poor. We're also bringing that on board now to encourage mothers to make sure they breastfeed exclusively for 6 months.
But better health care only goes so far in alleviating widespread poverty. Whoever is elected as Nigeria's new leader on Saturday faces the challenge of improving the economy so more Nigerian children can live long and healthy lives. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Pope Francis has opened an unprecedented Vatican summit on what he termed the wound of sexual abuse perpetrated by men of the church. Vatican officials called the meeting a powerful and intense experience for all those attending. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Prayers and the video testimonies of five unidentified sex abuse survivors from different continents opened the summit. Victims recounted their traumatic experiences. At a Vatican briefing following the opening session, Father Hans Zollner, president of the Center for the Protection of Minors, said the testimonies were brutal, honest, and nothing was spared. Archbishop Charles Scicluna of Malta, top sexual abuse investigator for the Vatican, said the voices they heard were emotional and powerful.
In order to understand the gravity of the situation, you need to listen to victims, meet them, because that is sacred ground.
The Pope summoned bishops from all over the world to come together to discuss what has become the most serious crisis and scandal of the Catholic Church, the sexual abuse perpetrated by members of the clergy. Pope Francis said the Church must listen to the cry of the little ones seeking justice. In his opening statement, Pope Francis told those gathered that the holy people of God are looking to us, expecting not simple and predictable condemnations, but concrete and effective measures to be undertaken. He stressed, "We need to be concrete." Philippines Cardinal Luis Tagle was the first to address the gathering of some 200 participants in the Vatican Synod Hall after the Pope. He choked up as he said that wounds have been inflicted by us, the bishops, on the victims.
Our lack of response to the suffering of victims, even to the point of rejecting them and covering up the scandal to protect perpetrators and the institution, has injured our people, leaving a deep wound in our relationship with those we are sent to serve.
Archbishop Scicluna, the next to address the gathering, said it is our duty to protect our people and to ensure justice when they are abused. He added, "We will protect them at all costs." Scicluna made clear that the Church must look carefully at how priests and bishops are chosen. He said the question of screening of future candidates for the priesthood remains of the essence. Ahead of the meeting, sex abuse survivors said they also want to see clergy found guilty of perpetrating or covering up abuse to be removed from their positions. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. New airstrikes have targeted the last Islamic State enclave. U.S. military conducts an observation flight over Russia. The U.S. embassy is demanding access to a U.S. investor indicted by a Moscow court. And Malawi's albinos are looking to asylum to escape attacks. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Police in Chicago say a U.S. actor who claimed he was attacked and beaten by two masked men shouting racist and homophobic slurs staged the incident because he was dissatisfied with his salary and wanted to promote his career. Jussie Smollett was arrested early Thursday and charged with felony disorderly conduct for making a false police report. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
The 36-year-old black, openly gay actor, featured on the U.S. television drama Empire, created a social media storm last month when he told police that two apparent supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump had beaten him, put a noose around his neck, and poured bleach over him. Smollett received an outpouring of support from celebrities and some lawmakers, but police immediately found inconsistencies in the actor's story. After a three-week investigation, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson said authorities determined Smollett paid two brothers $3,500 to stage the attack.
This announcement today recognizes that Empire actor Jussie Smollett took advantage of the pain and anger of racism to promote his career. I'm left hanging my head and asking why. Why would anyone, especially an African-American man, use the symbolism of a noose to make false accusations? How could someone look at the hatred and suffering associated with that symbol and see an opportunity to manipulate that symbol to further his own public profile. How can an individual who's been embraced by the city of Chicago turn around and slap everyone in this city in the face by making these false claims?
Johnson called the actor's publicity stunt a scar that Chicago didn't deserve. The charge against Smollett carries a penalty of up to 3 years in prison, though former Cook County prosecutor Andrew Weisberg told the Associated Press that judges rarely put defendants in prison for making false reports, opting instead to place them on probation. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
The Environmental Protection Agency this month issued an emergency exemption allowing U.S. farmers to use an insecticide linked to declines in vulnerable bee populations. The crops to be sprayed with the pesticide sulfoxaflor are ones that attract bees. It's an emergency declaration that environmentalists say has been chronically misused. Joining us to talk more about that is Nathan Donnelly, a senior scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity. Thank you for being with us. So can you tell us about the argument of the substance to be used due to an emergency?
This is what's called an emergency exemption in our pesticide law in the U.S. called FIFRA. It allows for emergency uses of pesticide to be applied in the United States, even if that pesticide has not been approved through the normal review process. So what's happened in the Trump administration right now, and actually in previous administrations as well, is they've been using the emergency process to approve pesticides where really no emergency actually exists. A lot of these emergency exemptions have been granted for many, many consecutive years in a row. So this is no longer an emergency. It's more of a foreseeable event. And what's happening with sulfoxaflor, which is the pesticide that is being approved and it's very harmful to bees, is that it is approved for some crops in the United States, but most of those crops are not flowering crops, so there's really no risk to pollinators. But it's being approved now on an emergency basis for sorghum as well as cotton, which are both plants that bees and other pollinators. So the risk is that farmers can be using this pesticide on these crops. It could then get into the pollen and nectar of those crops, and then pollinators would be exposed. And we have a crisis already ongoing, not only in the U.S., but in the world, where pollinators are declining rapidly, and agricultural pesticide use is a major factor in that decline.
And this is 16 million acres, I understand, of an area that, as you said, has crops that attract bees. And we just saw a very alarming report about the world's insects.
You're right. A report was published very recently in a peer-reviewed journal looking at insect decline across the world, and they found that a little more than 40% of all insect species are in decline, and total biomass has gone down. We're seeing precipitous declines across pretty much all types of insects, and that's worrisome. Insects are a huge, important part of the food chain. They're very low on the food chain, and they affect everything above them on the food chain. And so losing these insects not only affects the pollination of crops that humans and other animals rely on for food security, but also just the impact they have to the ecosystems in which they evolved. This is all being put in peril by human activity.
These 16 million acres, was this something that farmers in particular went to the EPA about and said, please let us use this?
These emergency exemption requests are generally requested by state departments of agriculture for farmers in their state to be able to use whatever pesticide is being applied for on their crops. This particular instance with sulfoxaflor, these 16 million acres are spread pretty much throughout the country. It was approved in 2018 in 18 different states. Anywhere where cotton or sorghum is commonly grown will likely have had an emergency exemption request for this pesticide. The major reason is that the pesticides that used to be used to kill the pests on those particular crops have evolved resistance to other pesticides that have been used. And so now this newish pesticide, sulfoxaflor, comes on the market. And even though it can't make it through a proper safety review, it's being used on a quote-unquote emergency basis because other pesticides simply don't work anymore. The insects have evolved resistance to it.
How dire a situation could this new approval of these 16 million acres be for the survival of bees?
That's a good question. And the problem is there wasn't a proper review done by this. So I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to that question, quite frankly. The EPA does not follow up on these emergency approvals and make sure that they didn't do major damage. So without the EPA looking into this, it's sort of a question that remains unanswered. We know this pesticide is very harmful to bees. We know it gets into the pollen and nectar of these plants. And we know that bees visit these plants, so you don't need to be particularly smart to know that there's probably some harm occurring on it.
How dire of a situation is it for the world's population of bees?
Oh, it's really dire. The report I just mentioned about the 40% insect decline, they pointed their finger at agriculture as the major driver of this, mainly through the use of pesticides. So there's obviously a lot of things. Bees are being hit by a lot of things. Global climate change is harming everything. But pesticide use is one that we have absolute control over right now.
That's Nathan Donnelly, a senior scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
VOA's International Edition continues. The 91st Academy Awards ceremony takes place this Sunday in Los Angeles. But before the actors and directors walk the red carpet to talk about their films, an exhibition showcasing costumes from Oscar-nominated movies opened in Los Angeles. Angelina Bagdasaryan has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Fashion designer Nick Verrios seems to know everything there is to know about movie costumes. For him, the costumes used and worn in Oscar-nominated movies are of special significance, both because of how carefully they were designed and how deceptive they can be.
I want you to look in the collar, the ruffles. Those are not ruffles. That's paint. That bow? No, not a bow. It's paint. His bow tie. Look at that. It's fabric, but painted to look like a bow tie. The buttons. These are painted buttons. So this is all hand-painted.
The wonderful costumes from the movie Mary Poppins Returns were created by seasoned Hollywood designer Sandy Powell. She has been nominated for her work in two films, Mary Poppins Returns and The Favourite.
Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of The Favourite, specifically told the costume designer, I do not want it to be historically accurate. So if you watch the movie, there might be some costume people that might be like, oh, that's not right. That's not historical. That's because it's supposed to not be. Vinyl, laser cut trim, that was not of the 1700s. So this is new technological, fresh fabric that she wanted to use. Look at the servant in the back. Now that is the character of Abigail, of course. Now look at the fabric. Denim.
Denim found its way into another historical movie. Costume designer Alexandra Byrne chose the fabric for the film Mary, Queen of Scots.
This gown right here, this is all denim. That blue gown, this indigo blue, that is denim, meaning the fabric of jeans. Look at this outfit right here. It's not leather, it's not suede. Look at that. It's denim.
But the main Oscar contender in costume design seems to be Ruth Carter, who created costumes for Black Panther. Together with her team, Carter traveled through Africa and Asia, studying traditions, history, and of course, fashion.
Purple means royalty. It is the color of the kings, the color of royalty. So once again, color is very important. The costume designer, Ruth Carter, she was inspired by Issey Miyake, Japanese designer.
Each of these costumes cost between $25,000 and $40,000, but not all of them are for sale. Sometimes they're given to the actors who wore them as a gift, or the fashion creations end up in museums. But one thing is certain, none of them will be easily forgotten. For Angelina Bogdasaran in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And finally in music news.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void?
Just days before the Academy Awards, in which she's nominated for that song and her starring role in A Star Is Born, Lady Gaga says she and talent agent Christian Carino are no longer engaged. They'd begun dating in 2017. The 32-year-old Lady Gaga was previously engaged to actor Taylor Kinney. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And meanwhile,
oh, I could hide beneath the wind.
Peter Tork, a singer-songwriter and instrumentalist who was known for his role as a goofy, lovable bass guitarist in the made-for-television rock band The Monkees, has died at the age of 77. Tork's son said his father died Thursday morning at the family home in Connecticut of complications from a rare cancer that he'd battled since 2009. Tork, who was often hailed by the other Monkees as the band's best musician, had studied music since childhood. He was accomplished on guitar, bass, keyboards, banjo, and other instruments, but Tork said he played bass because none of the others wanted to. When the show debuted in September 1966, he and his fellow band members became overnight teen idols. During its two-year run, the show would eventually win an Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series, and the group itself landed 7 songs in Billboard's Top 10. 3 of their songs, I'm a Believer, Daydream Believer, and Last Train to Clarksville, reached number 1. After the show ended in 1968, the band went on a lengthy concert tour that at one point included Jimi Hendrix as the opening act. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day. Oh.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy.